Well, actually, it might be good to start with some questions right now. If you've got one that's burning away, why don't you go ahead and ask it? Yes. That's a great question. And I need to just summarize it for the sake of the tape here. If one's working in a situation, as you are, with many unbelievers and able to talk with them openly and freely about the things that are going on in their lives, and all of you will find this. If you commit yourself to really getting alongside people, they are going to open their hearts to you and they're going to tell you about themselves and the things that they're involved in, many of which will be immoral. As you said in your situation, these women sharing their lives, and many of them involved in all sorts of immoral practices, sexually and in other things too, I'm sure. How are we to deal with this as Christians? How do we begin to address the issue of the universality of God's moral commandments in such a situation? When is it appropriate to speak? When is it appropriate to be silent? When is it appropriate simply to seek to live the truth as imperfectly as we do in front of them? Is that an adequate summary? Okay. That's a great question. And I could easily spend the whole class on this, having just said what I did about not spending too long answering questions. But I would just say to all of you, this is the kind of situation you ought to commit yourself to being in for the rest of your lives. That is, getting to know people well enough and them trusting you enough that they will start sharing who they are and the things that are going on in their lives. Now, for most Christians, and what we might say for the church as a whole, the workplace is the front line of evangelism. Not for those of you who are going to be pastors, but for almost everyone in your congregations. That's going to be the place where they're going to be developing the deepest relationships with unbelievers and having the possibility of getting to know people really well. Now, some of you have this kind of contact with members of your family. One of the women in class yesterday in the other class said that just in talking to her brother, who she's doing her paper for, she was very excited on the one hand to learn her brother's completely postmodern. It's exactly what I've been talking about in this class. On the other hand, it was very distressing to her to realize that this is how he thinks about his life, that he's a complete moral relativist, etc. So many of you have members of your family like this, involved in all sorts of sins, sexually and in many, many other ways. So how do we deal with that? Say, first of all, pray. That's the most important thing you can do, because God saves people you can't. So pray for them. Pray for your relationship with them. Pray that God will give you open doors to communicate the truth in His time. And be prepared to wait for God to open the door and to give you the opportunity. Because if you try to push too hard, the door will be slammed shut in your face and the people won't talk to you anymore. So first, pray. That really is the most important thing you can do. The Holy Spirit is the witness par excellence. He is the one who convicts people of sin and righteousness and judgment. That's not your task. That's His task, to convict people of sin. Secondly, live the truth. You're never going to do it perfectly, but God calls you to live faithfully, a life of righteousness before the person. Thirdly, talk with them as much as you can. You don't need to respond when they share with you their immorality in whatever area. Well, that's sinning against God's commandments. There may be a time when it's appropriate to say that. But all of you who have family members who are involved in sin of one kind or another know that that's not the place where you can start communicating with them. If you do, they will just not talk to you anymore. I used this example about my dad before. He used to swear every third word and blaspheme all the time. I never talked to him about it, because there were far more important things that he needed to deal with in terms of the existence of God in the first place. He was a communist. He didn't believe in God. When he became a believer, he stopped swearing and blaspheming, just like that, without me or anyone else saying anything. You need to discern what's the primary area where the person needs to be addressed. And it may very well not be the particular sin in which they're involved. Let's say they're sleeping with their boyfriend or whatever the issue is. And that will be true of most of them out there. That's true of almost everybody out there. They're sinning in that particular area, but also in lots of other areas. Just think of it. You see, we sometimes make the mistake as Christians of thinking that if they're involved in sexual sins, we've got to address those instantly. Everybody out there is a materialist. You don't say to them, you're materialistic and this is an offense against the law of God. But you're materialistic yourselves. It's not so easy to say it. You may not be living with your girlfriend, unmarried, but you're sinning in all sorts of other areas. That's why you've got to take the beam out of your own eye first. If they're proud, and almost all of them are, you don't say to them, listen, you're proud and God hates pride. That's not the way you can approach somebody. And you know that because you struggle with pride yourself. And it's inappropriate for us to pick out particular sins, let's say like sexual sins, as if those are the ones, as a Christian, I feel compelled to address with every unbeliever, when there are many other sins I would never think of addressing because it would so obviously be inappropriate to do so. Not that one wouldn't at some point talk about sins of materialism and pride. Of course you will. But the issue is, are you going to have a kind of judgmental relationship with this person where you feel compelled to be pointing out their sins all the time? If you do, no unbeliever will ever talk to you. You have to find what is the fundamental area where you can begin to challenge this person. And I've before used this image on the board, and we'll talk more about it later, of this area of overlap between a person's life and God's world. With the issue of morality, what I will always try to do is address the area where the person does hold on to absolute moral values. That is where they're still in touch with God's world. With my father, for example, again, here was a man who had passionately strong views, absolute moral standards about sexual fidelity and purity and integrity in the workplace. And those were the points where we could start to talk, where he was in touch with the truth, because these things really mattered to him. Now, the point where I was able to challenge him as we talked further was that there was no basis for those within his Marxism. So he's holding this truth in unrighteousness, to quote the apostles' words. I hope that's helpful for the moment. We'll come back to this issue later, I'm sure. Okay, were there other questions from last time? Because I know quite a few of you had your hands up at the end. Yes. That's a good question. Would one classify somebody who's postmodern as an agnostic? That is someone who's uncertain about the existence of God, or as someone who is an atheist? That's a good question, and I'll say simply, the great majority of people out there who are thoroughly shaped by postmodernism still believe in God in some sense. Most Americans do. Something like 90-92% of our contemporaries have some belief in God. That doesn't stop them from being postmodern. Most people out there believe in God, but they have no sense of accountability to God. They have no sense whatsoever that they're going to have to stand before God one day and face what he has to say about their lives, to face him as their judge. People find it almost impossible not to believe in God because it's so obvious that we're living in a designed and created universe. No matter how strongly people are taught evolution and anything else, they continue to think that there must be some kind of creator there. But even though they still have some acknowledgement of God, their lives are very shaped by postmodern ideas. So to speak about postmodernism is not saying that somebody's necessarily an atheist, though some of them are. You could say that the most consistent postmodern people are atheists. But nobody is completely consistent. Oh, postmodern people are moral relativists. That is, they deny that there are absolute moral standards and say that morality is simply a matter of individual choice or the majority or whatever. But all of them, nobody's consistent to that, thank God. Everybody has some areas in their life where they say there are certain moral standards which are clear. They all think, for example, that rape is wrong. You won't find anybody defending it. They all think sexually molesting children is wrong. You won't find anyone defending that. Not publicly, anyway. And you could take a whole lot of other areas, too. Nobody's a consistent moral relativist. So in describing people as postmodern, one isn't saying that people have completely lost touch with the truth, they've completely lost touch with moral order, or even that they've completely lost touch with God. They can't, in fact, completely lose touch because they're living before God. They're living in a universe God made. They're made in the image of God. So there's always going to be this kind of tension in their lives. There's always going to be, coming back to this image, the overlap here. So they will have some acknowledgement of God. New Age people are thoroughly postmodern, but they would all say they believe in God in some sense. But that's a good question. Yes. Other questions here before we go on, or are we ready to move forward? Matt? That's a very interesting question. I had spoken about postmodernism rejecting meta-narratives. That is an account which claims to be the truth about the human condition, and yet one may find in a sort of repackaged Marxism in some of the kind of culture wars that are going on between men and women, minorities and the majority, etc. Is this the reintroduction of a meta-narrative? I guess that's your question. It's a very good question. You remember I said last time or maybe the time before, sometime last week, in the last couple of weeks, that people have idols of the mind. When they stop believing in God, they're going to believe in some account of reality. I think people cannot be consistent here. They feel compelled to reintroduce some kind of story which is going to make sense of the human condition. It's part of what it means to be human. We need to have some sense of who we are and where we're from and where we're going to and what we're here for. And even if that story, if you like, says that life is absurd, it's or if that story is one where I adopt the sort of political motif of Marxism with its warfare between this group and that group, people are attracted to such things. You know, any kind of New Age set of ideas that someone gets involved in claim to be a new kind of account of reality. So it's like saying there's a God. Remember I talked about idolatry. It's like saying God, there's a God-shaped hole in the mind, and people are going to replace the loss of the biblical true account with some other story. So that while there's this rejection in theoretical postmodernism of a story which makes sense, people are going to be reintroducing one in some way or other. It's a good question. In our outline, we were talking about the loss of moral direction. And at the end, we had been discussing whether we personally hold on to God's law. Do we love God as the lawgiver? Do we love his commandments? Are we committed to living in obedience to him? Or are we becoming postmodern like so many other people and living just simply to serve ourselves? And this brings us to point C under here. Are we communicating in word and life the beauty of righteousness? Do we live the truth in a way which commends the law of God, which commends true righteousness to people? Jesus challenges us in Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. He says that we are the salt of the earth and we are the light of the world. And he's talking about our lives when he says those words. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good deeds and give glory to your Father in heaven. That's your calling in the coffee shop, to live such good lives before the people you work with that they may see your good deeds and give glory to your Father in heaven. Well, this is where the rubber meets the road for the Christian. We are called to live in the world alongside unbelievers and before unbelievers, but to live in a way which always commends the truth to them. Peter says the same thing in 1 Peter 2, verse 12. He says, live such good lives before the pagans that they will glorify God. What do people see when they look at your life? Do they see the ugliness of self-righteousness, a person who thinks that they're right in everything and who's condemning them? It comes back to the first question. Who's constantly pointing out other people's faults? Or do they see somebody who lives a life of genuine beauty? Righteousness is beautiful. And 1 Peter 3, verse 7, Peter writing to women whose husbands are unbelievers, and his words apply to anybody who has family members who are non-Christians, people who know you really well. If you have a brother or a sister or a father or a mother or a spouse or a child or a close uncle or aunt or grandparents, if you've got members of your family and people you've known, close friends for many, many years, Peter says this, win them without a word by your behavior. Those are the words of Scripture. Win them without a word by your behavior. When they see the beauty and reverence of your lives, that's how Peter addresses women whose husbands are unbelievers. Win them without a word by your behavior. He's not saying you're forbidden to speak. He's saying, but especially in a relationship where somebody knows you really well, your primary calling in that relationship is not words, but your life. Are you demonstrating the beauty of righteousness? Paul says the same thing in Philippians 2, 15 through 16. He says that we're to shine like stars in the midst of a crooked and depraved generation. And does your life shine like a star? If you think about where you live in your neighborhood and the unbelievers around you, the places where you work, where there are non-Christians there in the workplace, is your life shining like a star? Well, it's called to. Or Paul in Titus chapter 2, verse 10, he's talking about workplaces very explicitly there. And he says, make the teaching about God our Savior attractive by the way you work. What sort of model of integrity do you have? Do people see you as somebody who works faithfully, who works hard? And not just when somebody's watching you, and Paul talks about this in Colossians 3, 22 through 24. Not when just somebody's got their eye on you, but because as a matter of obedience to God and delight in serving Him, you always work hard and you work with integrity. For those, if you're in a position of authority in your workplace, what would people under your authority say about you? That you're a jerk, that you're demanding, that you're difficult to work for, that you're never pleased, you're impossible to please? Well, if that's what people say about you, you have betrayed the gospel. If people look at you and say, well, you know, we got to keep this guy on, but he's actually just, he's lazy, he sleeps on the job, he's always gossiping with people, he's taking stuff home from work. Well, you have brought discredit on the name of Christ. We're called to live righteously, and righteousness is beautiful. Now, your life needs to shine like the life of Christ shone. He was enormously attractive to people, because true righteousness is beautiful. And when we communicate righteousness to people, do we communicate it as something beautiful? Or do we communicate a set of kind of just a lot of rules about the way we think people should live? So are we living and communicating God's commandments as something truly beautiful? And that brings us to main point three here, the loss of relationships and community. And we spoke about this, the breakdown of community in our culture, and fundamentally, how, while there are maybe all sorts of sociological reasons for that, you know, from the existence of cars to many other things, and the way we live in suburbs, etc., you know, at the heart of the breakdown of community is our culture's insistence that the individual lives just to please themselves. And wherever you have individuals living just to pursue their own happiness as their fundamental goal, you're going to have the breakdown of community. If that's your approach to marriage, your marriage will end in disaster. If that's how you treat your children, you know, they will leave home as soon as they can, and you will destroy the possibility of any depth of relationship with them. The pursuit of happiness of the individual is completely destructive of community in every context, whether it's marriage, the family, or any other part of our society. Now, let's think about the challenges that this causes to us. The church is criticized for its lack of community. One of the most common criticisms of churches is that they are simply programs. And I used this figure before, but between one-third and one-half of all people who come to churches and join them leave within a year. And their primary criticism is the lack of relationships in the church. Lots of programs, lots of busyness, but that it was difficult to get to know people. Everyone was so busy filling their slot, doing their thing, running their program. Nobody had time for relationships. Churches are criticized as just preaching points. One of my own sons, when we moved here, after church, when Sunday we were driving home and he was sitting in the back of the car. He was about 14 or 15 years old and he had tears rolling down his face. And I said to him, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I miss the familyness." And that was his comment about our church. That there was no depth of relationships. He did not feel like it was a family of which he could be a part. That there were just cliques among the kids, depending on which school they went to, who weren't prepared to really talk to anybody else and to get to know them. And at the time, I pled with a couple of our students who were leading the youth group in that church. I said, "Please make a personal effort to try to get our sons involved." And what they got was a card through the mail. Not any kind of personal, truly personal attempt to involve them in the community of the church. It was the thing they found most difficult. I'll say that for myself. Coming here, when we moved here 12 years ago, the most difficult thing for my family was becoming part of the community of the church. And that was with a goodwill and a longing to be so. But that's what my kids found really, really difficult. It's not a criticism of any particular church. That's just a general problem, that new people in churches have a very hard time really entering into the community life of the church. And this is a major barrier for postmodern people as they look at the church. Now, this brings us to our second point here under this. What about me, myself, and what about our own church? Does my church, does my life have a reality of community in it? Are we so personally shaped by the culture, so busy in our own things that we have to do, whether it's in the programs of our church or the busyness of our own lives, that we have no time for relationships? Now, we can, as Christians, start living for ourselves and all the things that we're doing for God. And we completely forget about our calling to love our neighbor as ourself and to give ourselves to community and to relationships. I always remember, this was many, many years ago, talking to a woman who was involved, very heavily involved, in teaching Bible studies, which of course is a wonderful thing. Who's going to speak against that? I'm sure you're all involved in teaching Bible studies, but she said to me, "I just got so active. You know, I was constantly involved." And she said, "One day I was sitting at our kitchen table with my kids and with the woman who I had hired to help look after them. And my little boy, who was 3, said this to me, 'Now, are you my mummy or is she my mummy?'" And she said, that really caused me to think again about what I was doing. What is it God calls me to do? Now, I'm not speaking against mothers teaching Bible studies or against mothers working. That's not my point at all, so don't be offended by what I said. You could use the same illustration of a father. Fathers are much more guilty of the problem here than mothers, of spending no time at all with their children. What I'm asking is this: are you committed to relationships? Now, you can do thousands of things for God, preaching, teaching, all sorts of other things, running church programs. But if you are not giving yourself to relationships, whether in your own family or in the family of the church, you've missed what is fundamental to the nature of the gospel. Now, think of how strongly the New Testament puts it. Jesus in John 13, 34 and 35 says this. He says, "A new commandment I give you, that you love one another." And then he says this: "By the way you love one another, all men will know that you are my disciples." By the way you love one another, all men will know that you are my disciples. And in John 17, 20 through 23, in Jesus' high priestly prayer, he prays on the night before he dies. He says this, that by the quality of our relationships, by the unity we have, people will know that the Father sent the Son. People draw conclusions about the truth of the Christian message when they see the reality of our lives. They draw conclusions about what God has done to save us when they see the way we relate to each other. You might say, well, what's that got to do with it? You know, surely I need to preach that the Father sent the Son, and that's how people respond to that. Of course we do, but Jesus says people will know that the Father sent the Son by the quality of our relationships. God is a community. The Trinity is a community. Through all eternity, the Father and the Son and the Spirit have loved each other and served each other and sought to honor each other and to bring glory to each other. And we are called, as those made in the image of God, to live in community too. To give ourselves to honor and serve and love others. Francis Schaeffer used to put it this way all the time. Love is the mark of the Christian. Love is the mark of the Christian. And the New Testament teaches us that very clearly. If you turn to 1 John chapter 4, John writes about this. 1 John 4, verses 7 onwards. "Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins." Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. But if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is made complete in us. People don't see God. They see you. In this life, they're never going to see God. He's invisible to us until we see Christ face to face. But they see you. No man has ever seen God, But God lives in us, and His love is to be made complete in us. And that's an amazing statement. You'd think it was almost blasphemous if the Scripture didn't say it. Now, isn't God's love complete already in the Trinity and in the way He's loved us in Jesus Christ? Well, John says, well, no, wait a minute. God's love has got to be manifested and made complete in your life. That's how people are going to find out about God, by seeing the reality of love in your life. And later on, down in verses 19 through 21, John adds some words. We love because He first loved us. If anyone says, I love God, yet hates his brother, he's a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he's not seen. And He's given us this command. Whoever loves God must also love his brother. And what is love? John speaks about it in 1 John 3, verses 16 down through 18. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down His life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. Oh, do we love the Trinity, who is community? Do we live the Trinity where there is love for one another and service of one another and honor for one another? And do we put that into practice in our lives so that people see a reality of the love of God in us? God demands that that's what they be able to see. Now, this brings us to our third point here. Do we welcome the broken people of our postmodern culture into our community, into our churches, into our lives, into our homes? You might say, but postmodern people have messy lives. They're sexually unfaithful. They have all kinds of other problems. But it's precisely broken, sinful people who we are called to welcome into our churches, into our homes, and into our lives. And to do so gladly. But we live in a generation that values relationships more highly than it values propositional truth. That doesn't mean we must abandon the communication of propositional truth. Our culture is dying for the loss of truth. We have to communicate truth. But people won't pay any attention to us at all, no matter how passionately and loudly we declare the truth, unless they see a reality of relationships. In fact, most of them will never come within the hearing of the truth unless they are attracted to it by seeing the reality of love in our lives. Whether it's people you're meeting in the coffee shop where you work or anything else, if they don't see a reality of love, they won't ever even talk to you and open their lives to you. The more you love them, the more they will open themselves to you and share the brokenness as well as the joys of their life. The way people should respond to our churches is like this. I always remember a couple who started coming to our church saying this. They had lived in many different places, And I said to them, why are you coming to church? And they said, well, we've lived in various parts of Africa, in Kenya, in Tanzania. We've lived in the Netherlands. We've lived in Italy. We've lived in different parts of Britain. And we lived here and there. But this is, we have never seen a community like this. And we want to be part of it. And that's how people should respond to our churches. There is to be a reality of community. Now, the church I worship with right now is a black church that meets down the road here, and it is a very high level of a reality of community. There's a young couple who came to the church last year in April, and they got married in July. They were already engaged when they came to the church. And the women of the church did the whole wedding for them. They were only there 3 months. And everybody knew they were leaving right after their wedding. And they wouldn't be back. And the women of the church prepared all the food. The church did the music. One of the women in the church basically took the place of this girl's mother, who wasn't going to help her in any way. One of the women in the church got close to her and basically ran the wedding for her. And everybody did it for nothing, just for love. And that's what it means to be a Christian. And that's the way our churches are to be. To have that kind of commitment to community, to loving one another, to caring for people. When my wife was having her cancer surgery a couple of years ago and going through chemotherapy afterwards, it was just an awful time. But we experienced such a high level of community from our colleagues on the faculty here and from the members of our church. I will never forget it. And it had an enormous impact on other people. When people came, nurses and doctors and visitors to other patients came past my wife's room in the hospital, there were like 35 bunches of flowers in there. There were so many flowers that a room for two people had to be converted to a room for just one, because there wasn't room for two beds in there with all the flowers. And people, doctors and nurses and visitors and other patients would come in and say, there's sure a lot of people who love you. It had an enormous impact on people. My pastor, Bob Loggins, came and spent the whole 5 hours with me in the hospital when my wife was having her surgery. I will never forget that. And people who were in the hospital saw it too. Community, when it's real, has an enormous impact on people's lives. Kathy Chappell and Polly Long and Mary Pat Peterson came and scrubbed our floors for 6 months and washed our toilets every couple of weeks when my wife was terribly ill. That's community. That's community. And when I thanked Kathy Chappell one day, she said, it's an honor to do this. And she meant it. Now, that's community. That's what we are called to, all of us, in our relationships with one another and in our churches. That's what people should see. That kind of glad service of one another, which takes time and is costly. And it's very beautiful to see. And it's that is going to impact our postmodern generation, that kind of reality of community. Number four, the loss of respect for authority. Now, we've spoken about the way authority is under attack in our postmodern culture. And again, just briefly, to go through these points. When we claim authority for our churches, for our creeds, our confessions, for our teaching, for our pastors, for our church leaders, this is offensive to people. This is offensive to people. People see the claim to authority as absurd. At the time of the Heaven's Gate tragedy, there were a series of articles in the Post-Dispatch at that time about the kind of strange ideas of that cult. But several of the articles said this, that really the ideas of the Heaven's Gate cult were no more bizarre and absurd than the claims of Christianity. You know, Christ is going to come again in person. We're going to see him. He's going to reign on the earth and establish his kingdom. And the people writing the article said, well, that's really no more bizarre what the Heaven's Gate people teach than what churches teach, what Christians teach. You know, the claim to the authority of our teaching is just considered a bizarre and absurd claim by people around us. That's why people find church discipline such an impossible idea to get their minds around. And this means Christians too. And so this is the question I want to ask us. What about us? How do we deal with authority ourselves? Are we shaped by the culture so that we are cynical about all authority as well? We already talked about this a bit. But what I really want to get at here is the third point, and that is this. What kind of authority are we displaying in our churches? What do people see? One of the problems that we wrestle with is that in reaction to the attack on authority in the culture, there's a lot of teaching in the evangelical church which says the answer to the problem of the culture, to the breakdown of authority and to the moral breakdown, the answer is just to have more and more authority in the church. So we got this very heavy teaching of the chain of command. You know, just got to live in obedience to your husband, your father, your elders, the state, whoever it happens to be. Unquestioned obedience, we just submit to this chain of command coming down from God through the authorities. And along with that heavy emphasis on the chain of command and the increase of authority in our homes and our churches, there's just endless legalistic teaching. What we need is lots of rules telling people what to do in every circumstance. Well, neither of those are biblical authority in any way. And they're just ugly. Now, what kind of authority are we displaying? It needs to be the authority of the servant king. Now, Jesus says about himself, he came not to be served, but to serve. And he's the Lord of the universe. Though he was the disciples' Lord and Master, he washed their feet. He was a servant. And he calls us to serve in the same kind of way. Those two passages, Matthew 20, verses 25 through 28, where Jesus says he came to serve. And he calls us to serve as well. Matthew 20, verses 25 through 28. And he's challenging his disciples when he says this, because they're wrestling with each other about who's going to have more authority. This is something you find a constant theme in the Gospels. The disciples arguing with each other about who's going to have the places of greatest power. Because when they think about authority, they think about power and status. So they grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. This is the mother of James and John. Now, those of you who are mothers and fathers know you want positions of status and authority for your kids. Well, she was no different. And Jesus' words are very challenging. The other ten are indignant about this, because they want the places themselves. It's not that they are just critical. They're saying that you tried to get in first here. Well, now I want to get my word in. There are several accounts in the Gospels of this kind of argument among them. And Jesus says this: "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." All of you are here because you feel God has called you to ministry of some kind. The word ministry is a problematic word, actually. It used to mean, in English, being a servant. We tend to forget that. That's all that ministry means. To be a minister means to be a servant. We've turned it into a title of status and power. I can't tell you to abandon the word, but we need to remember what it really means. Now, we have been called to be servants. Whoever feels called by God to a place of teaching or leadership among God's people has got to remember what Jesus says: you're called to be a servant. And over a little further in Matthew chapter, 23, Jesus talks about how our attitude should be to positions of authority and leadership in the church. Matthew 23, verse 5, he's talking about the scribes and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and to have men call them rabbi. Now, that happens very easily in our churches. We have special seats of honor for pastors and people in authority. We like to be greeted. It's one of the temptations you're all going to face. Those of you who become pastors or in any positions of leadership, do you like to be greeted in public places as pastor? It makes your chest swell a little bit and you feel good about yourself. Do you like have an important seat, you know, if you get invited to a church dinner somewhere? Everybody's got to look up to you. Well, that's what Jesus is talking about. But you are not to be called rabbi. You have only one master, and you are all brothers. And don't call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he's in heaven. Nor are you to be called teacher, for you have one teacher, the Christ. The greatest among you will be your servant. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Now, we don't pay much attention to this biblical passage, but we should. Whether you like the title pastor or teacher or whatever else it is, or counselor or anything else, you know, just junk it. That's what Jesus says. Yeah, you're called to be a servant. You're not going to go around rebuking people for calling you pastor or teacher. That's not my point. The issue is what's going on in your heart. And do you like that? Do you kind of swell with pride when people say this to you? Well, don't. Jesus calls you to be a servant. And then in John chapter 13, verses 12 through 17, this is after Jesus washes his disciples' feet. There he is crawling around the floor with a jug of water and a bowl, collecting the dirty water as he goes around just in his loincloth and a towel wrapped around his face, you know, around his waist, just stripped down. And you can imagine how quiet it got. Until he got to Peter, of course, who wasn't very good at keeping quiet in any circumstance whatsoever. But then after it's all over, Jesus says this: "Do you understand what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, You also should wash one another's feet. I've set you an example that you should do as I've done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent them. Now you know these things, you'll be blessed if you do them. This is what it means to lead the church in any way. You're called to be a servant. You're called to wash people's feet. And that may be literally. When we were out in California just recently, I had to wash my father-in-law's feet because he's getting elderly, he can't bend anymore, he can't wash his own feet. You may end up washing somebody's feet. But of course, Jesus means you take the place of lowliest service wherever you are. If you're married, with your wife, your husband, with your parents, with your children, with your friends, in your church, with people you work alongside, you're called to be a servant, to serve them. That is what Christ calls us to. This is the kind of authority we are to demonstrate. Now, I say to our students here, I may have said this in class already, but I don't mind repeating this one. If I come to visit you, if you invite me to come and speak in your church sometime, where some of you guys are going to be pastors, I'm not going to go and ask people, what kind of preacher are you? I'm going to go talk to the janitors and the secretaries and say, what's it like to work for this guy? What kind of a servant is he? Because that'll tell me far more about the genuinely Christian ministry you have than anything else that people in the church could tell me. Because if that's not there, it doesn't matter what else is. You're not imitating Christ. And you're not faithfully communicating the gospel. That's a great question. How do we respond to the appeal to Acts chapter 6 and say, well, actually, the apostles soon got past this and no longer waited on tables and just appointed deacons to do that because they didn't have time for such things. They only had time to preach the word and to pray. I would say, first, it's a misreading of the passage to say that the apostles are drawing the conclusion that it's inappropriate for them to be servants any longer. The point of the passage is simply that they had become so involved in overseeing the distribution of food and in serving people in that practical way that they were beginning to neglect the ministry of the word and prayer. What's interesting to notice is the kind of people they appoint to the task. They look for people who are filled with wisdom and the Holy Spirit, several of whom are later described as preachers and evangelists and teachers in the church and leaders of the church, to fulfill this task of serving at tables and overseeing the distribution of food. Now, it doesn't mean that the apostles stopped being servants. You can just think of the way Paul describes his own ministry over and over again. He says, I cared for you as a mother cares for her children. Now, I served you. I will gladly not only expend everything I have for you, but expend my life as well. That's how Paul describes his own ministry. You, no matter what the press of teaching and preaching is, and prayer, you are never to get beyond the point of being a servant. Now, obviously, there is so much service, practical service in any church, that you could spend your whole time doing nothing but that, and you would end up having no time to teach and preach, etc., at all. And that's not right. If God has called you to minister his word to people, but you never grow beyond being a servant. Now, you say, well, now I'm the pastor of a church this size, I don't have to serve anymore. Jesus is the pastor of the whole church. and he washed his disciples' feet. And what's beautiful about that passage, you read John 13, it says at the beginning of the passage, he was determined to show them the full extent of his love. And then what he does is wash their feet. And all of us, what Luke's gospel teaches us is that when we come into the kingdom and sit down at the marriage supper of the Lamb at Christ's banqueting table, it says he's going to serve us again. Now, he's never going to get beyond service. That's what it says in Luke 12. Christ will serve us at the fulfillment of the Last Supper, just as he served his disciples. So you don't get beyond it, ever. Yes, you're going to give yourself to the ministry of teaching and preaching, if that is what God has called you to, and prayer for his people. But if you stop being a servant, both in the attitude of your heart, how you think about yourself, and also practically in what you do, you know, then there's something wrong. You know, if people never see you waiting at tables, if they never see you serving your family, if you're always there, you know, I've seen pastors who say, well, I have such responsibility for teaching the word. I get up at 9:30 in the morning and my wife takes care of the family and does everything, and I go out and I minister the word of God to people, and I come home and I'm waited on like a baronet, like a lord, and you know, I do nothing in my home. Well, that's not biblical. That's not biblical. Now, I hope that if I visit any of you guys who are going to be pastors in your home, I see you serving your wife and serving your children in all sorts of practical ways and doing it gladly. Now, every morning of our married life, I have got up first and made my wife a cup of tea in bed and made breakfast for her every single day, basically, for 33 years. And I do so gladly. And that's how we're to be in our churches. So, yes, God will call you to lots of teaching, those of you who are called to be teachers. But don't you ever stop being a servant, because if you do, you betray the gospel. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. What about serving people who have the wrong attitude and who are unfit perhaps for communion, to receive the Lord's Supper or for Christian fellowship? Well, you know, there are only unfit people out there. Let's put it that way. There aren't anybody else. Jesus served these guys around this table, and just think about it. Every one of them was going to deny him that night, and he knew that. You know, they were his closest friends. He called to go to the Garden of Gethsemane with him and watch and pray with him, and they fell asleep. And then they're boasting, Lord, you know, even though all the rest deny you, I won't. You know, I'm strong, I've got it together, I'm an upstanding, faithful believer and disciple of yours. And they all denied him. I never knew the guy. Now, we're called to serve always unfit people. Now, there's a different question here in terms of whether everybody should be welcome to the Lord's table, a communion. And Scripture is quite plain that there are issues of sin which we have to deal with there. But in terms of service, practical service, we are called to serve people whoever they are. And you know, you're going to have lots of broken people coming to your churches, into your lives, into your homes from a postmodern culture, people filled with awful sin, and you need to serve them gladly. Yeah, even if they don't say thank you, even if they don't appreciate it, even if they don't love you back, you serve them gladly. Gladly. That's how Christ has served us. When we were unkind and ungrateful and took no attention at all, paid no attention at all to him, he died for us. And we are called to serve in the same way.